Okay, welcome back. In this last lecture, we were talking about high-speed router design, and we are going to continue on that topic. When we left off, we were overviewing the key ideas in switching, and we talked about the general notion of space division switching. And now, in this lecture, we are going to start off with a specific type of space division switching called crossbar. Okay, when people learn about crossbar, they think that it is the most general type of space division switching. It is not. There's something more general than that, which is what I talked about earlier, which is just generally to have separate paths from every input to output, direct paths, okay, not switched paths. Okay, what I mean by crossbar is that in a crossbar, if you notice, you don't have n squared or m times n, you don't have so many links inside the switch. What you have is you have n input links and you have m output links, and at these points you have these small circles which are known as switching elements. So the n square or n times n, m times n things here is not the entire set of paths, but it is the switching elements you have m times n. Okay, so these are what are known as switched paths. Okay, because you have these switching elements which actually provide these. Okay, and that's why these things were also called switches, right? They used to interconnect input to the output in an on-demand fashion. Okay, so that's why these things were called switches. But the most general form of switch is, I mean, you don't have to interconnect it upon demand. It's always there. Okay, so statically interconnect is the simplest form of space division switching. But a switched form of space division switching is the following. Where this is known as a crossbar design. The reason it's called crossbar is you have a bunch of bars, horizontal bars and vertical bars, which represent the input and output, and you have these elements called switching elements that are controlled by a centralized controller. Okay, and when these fellows show up, the controller figures which switching element to turn on. Okay, observe that in this particular design, when a packet comes from on one input, or when multiple packets come at this input at the input interface, you cannot send it simultaneously to all the output interfaces, whereas you could do that here in the prior diagram. Okay, here you're allowed to send it to at most one output at a time. It turns out to be sufficient for most reasons. Okay, and so then you'll have a path from this input to any output, and you have parallel paths. In other words, one can send to two, two can send to one, and so on and so forth. So what it means is that you can have up to n parallel paths, or minimum of n, if this n is not equal to m, you can have minimum of n comma m parallel paths at any time. Whereas in the prior design, you could have up to n square parallel paths at any time. Okay, so switched crossbar is actually one of the restricted versions of switching, but it is the thing which actually introduces the notion of switching elements. That's why it's often thought of as the basic space division switch. The number of paths which are required, physical paths which are required, is n plus m. N is the input and m is the output number of interfaces. And the number of switching points, though, you have lots of switching points. Okay, you have n times n or n cross n switching points. Okay, and also this controller needs to operate very fast. Okay, if you have to control so many switching elements, right? So this controller needs to be able to rapidly provision any of the switching elements to be open or closed. Okay. The other major advantage with the crossbar is that the port hardware can, that is the interface hardware here we see, input or output, both of them can operate very slowly, okay, much slower than the earlier design. So here, for example, I'm guaranteed only that one input will anyway dump traffic to one output at any time. Okay, so this output runs at the maximum speed of any of the input, that's fine. Okay, an input port can run independently at any speed. Okay, an input port needs to just run at line speed. Okay, so hardware speeds are very important, because I mean, if you want to make this fellow run m times as fast, it limits the size of m. Okay, you can't build switches which are large, because it's not a scalable thing, because hardware is not available for large m. Okay, so crossbar is the first design which provided the capability to build low cost interface hardware, okay, reasonably complex controllers which can control switching elements, okay, and these interconnection paths. Okay, But it turns out that if you want to build large crossbars, like if I want to build 1,000 by 1,000 crossbars, it's still a complex problem, because the number of switching elements suddenly starts growing dramatically, right? 1,000 by 1,000 means lots of switching elements, like a million switching elements, okay? Not very good, okay? So you can't do that. So today what happens is that typically you get cheap crossbars, which are smaller number of interfaces, like about 64 interfaces or 128 interfaces. So you can get a 64 by 64 crossbar, a fairly impressive feat, okay? You can get it on a single chip. It provides crossbar capability. Okay, and then what you do is, as I say, we can create multi-stage switches which can interconnect many of the small stages to form a larger network. Okay, and the primary reason you do that multi-stage switching is that you want to reduce the total number of cross points or the switching elements. Okay, once you have large number of switching elements, the complexity of controlling the switching element grows, which becomes a central bottleneck. Remember that whenever I talk about system design, right, there has to be some trade-off, right? Something has to be costly, something has to be cheap. Okay, so initially when links were cheap and interface hardware were cheap, I could build any number of links from all inputs to outputs. But now I said interface hardware is not that cheap. It's technologically not possible to build high speed interfaces for any M, right? So then you want to latch on to one speed of the interface, and then you come up with this crossbar design which basically explodes the number of switching points and the switch controller complexity. Now up to a point is manageable, beyond that it's not. So then you have to start sharing cross points over time, over space, okay? So, and that is known as a multi-stage switch design, okay? So that's the basic idea, okay? So you have to identify what is the key trade-off which is being optimized in a switch design, okay? And to handle contention, right? So as I said, it is still possible for output queues, it's still possible that you can have contention at the output. For example, the output link might not be available, so you might need to have a buffer to hold a packet, okay? Or if there are several, if the output does not run as fast as the inputs, right, you might be getting lots of packets coming into this output, so you might need to have a buffer which can hold on to these fellows, okay? So if there's a mismatch in terms of the input speeds and output speeds, it's possible that you want to buffer something, okay? So you can put output queues here. And similarly, if the switch, since it's shared, right? So in this particular crossbar design, there's nothing shared inside the switch. So what I mean is that it's internally non-blocking. Okay, meaning of internally non-blocking is you'll never have a problem of waiting for a switched path. Okay, whereas it is possible for you to have some degree of blocking in switches. Okay, and especially in multi-state switches. So so that's called a blocking probability calculation. So in fact, earlier, when people built telephone switches, they wanted to actually minimize this blocking probability or try to maximize the non-blocking probability, okay? So, and for that, if it blocks for whatever reason, maybe the output is not available or the switching fabric is not available, you need to have an input queue. So it turns out that input queue you need anyway, right? When packets show up here, you have to put in a queue, wait for the switch next slot to be available, and then shuttle the packet across, and you can reach the output, right? And it's possible that you can also have buffers at these cross points, okay? Those are known as buffered cross points, okay? But those switches, those designs are more rarer, okay? It's harder to build buffer cross points, much more costlier. So mostly all the buffering is concentrated at the input side or the output side, or there might be a pool of shared memory buffer like DRAM that's available. You basically dump all your payload into it, and then you just switch the header from through this infrastructure, and then essentially the output just picks up the packet from the shared memory. Okay, so these are all designs possible. Okay, another, as I said, space division fabrics, right? If you can share in space, then you can also share in time, right? So time division fabric sounds great. Okay, it sounds like sophisticated, but it's nothing but a bus. Okay, so when I say time division switching fabric, right, it's just a bus. Okay, think of a simple computer bus. What do you do? It's a shared medium. All of you cannot access it at the same time as you can do in a space division medium. You don't have parallel paths. So you have to access it or share it over time. You have to divide time and provide access to the shared resource over slots. Okay. Okay, now these could be called time slots, or they could be called cell slots, packet slots, but essentially it's you're dividing over time. Okay. Another more common name for it is time sharing, right? So when you are sharing the old mainframes, we were doing time sharing of those mainframes. So this is nothing but time sharing with the bus. Okay, now time division can be done in a synchronous or asynchronous or in a database thing or fixed time slots. All of these things are possible. Okay. Now, time division switching is very popular in telephony. Okay. In fact, if you look at sort of several of the today's switches, okay, one of the key functions several of them do is something known as time slot interchanging. Okay. So now, time slot interchanging is basically a shuffle operation. Okay, what it means is that if I have a telephone call that comes in time slot number 5 on one input port and it has to go out at time slot number 3 in the output port, what I have to do is first I have to do two things. I have to shuffle the time slot, okay, and then I have to get the packet to the output, right. So essentially they do a cute trick, okay, to combine both these operations, okay, and the basic observation is that if I take a bunch of time slots like 1 to 24, right, this is like a T1 line and I put it this way, right, and then I have this sort of time slot interchange which is just like a memory element which shuffles this time slots, and then I just do demultiplexing. Okay, so what I have done is after this multiplexing, shuffling and demultiplexing stage, now I have at the output of this demux stages essentially different time slots going out. If you notice, this thing is hard to read, but essentially what I have done here is this time slot 2 over here goes through this path and it has been swapped to go in this output path. Okay, so essentially what I have done is I have actually through the demux operation I have switched it from input to output. Okay, now you can have additional time slotting mechanisms. You can put a mux here which takes all the inputs that come to this particular interface number 2 and then multiplex it again and then shuttle it onto the wire. Okay, so time slot interchange is just a cute trick to shuffle time slots, and the shuffling is dictated by how the signaling has been set up. Okay, and through a combination of simple multiplexers, demultiplexers and the shuffle operation, which is a time slot interchanger, you can achieve the equivalent of a switching operation. Okay, what you have done, you have switched from input to output and you have switched from time slot to time slot. Right, that is the basic operation, and this whole thing is synchronous. Okay, so it's not only time sharing of the shared resources. So here, especially this slot thing, but you're also synchronous. It only happens at fixed instance of time. Okay, that's synchronous is a common feature in telephony, right? So it's a main idea of time division multiplexing. Now, another idea of time division, even though it doesn't sound like time division, is shared memory. Okay, if you take shared memory fabric, right, what a shared memory fabric is very simple. You just have a piece of memory, okay, you have a memory chip. It has a bunch of inputs and outputs. I call these inputs as input ports and outputs as output ports. So basically input ports will write to memory and output port will read from that memory. Okay, and I said this can be done, for example, for the payload, right. See, when I said packets show up at the input port, the input interface, I can strip out the payload and throw it into shared memory, okay, and when the output port is ready to pull it out, it can just access shared memory and pull it out. Okay, so the only constraints are in real memory, these memory interfaces, which I call ports, are very costly, okay, and it's very hard to make them extremely fast. So these, anything that's costly, first rule of system design is share it, right? So what you do is you have several quote-unquote ports which share memory interfaces, okay, which unfortunately are also called ports. Okay, so when you buy memory, right, you can sometimes buy quad memory or quad ported memory or dual ported memory. All this means is that you have the memory has these multiple interfaces and the interfaces have particular width. Okay, in other words, you can shuttle so many bits at the same time into that memory width, and you can have a bunch of physical sort of these real network ports sharing those interfaces. So obviously, if you do any sort of sharing, you're going to be limited by the aggregate bandwidth of those interfaces, right? So shared memory is limited by the speed and the width of its interfaces, and to some extent also by the speed of the memory controller, but usually that's less of an issue. Okay, so you could do some sort of clever shared memory design by having a sort of wide cells, okay, or wide memory cells, and essentially, and you can also have wide interfaces to memory. And you can share those interfaces by allocating pieces of those interfaces for different ports. So you can share that big interfaces in space and in time. Okay, so anytime when you want to share, you can share it in terms of space. That is, it's like a cake, you cut it up. Okay, memory has so much width. Okay, access width, you break it up and say, okay, first network port gets so much, second network ports get so much, and so on. And then after you're satisfied, another set of network ports can come and access it. Okay, so you can share it across time. So time sharing and space sharing are fundamental concepts in sharing. Okay, so it is possible for you to build a fairly sophisticated high-speed switch with a basic shared memory implementation. And as you can expect, all the $100 box I talked about in the other class, which is if you want to buy a Linksys router for your home, which connects to broadband like the cable modem, and then it also provides wireless services and gives you 5-port switch, usually gives a shared memory type design. Okay, parts cost this was when the book was written, it was $50. Now it's like $10 or less. So that's why you can buy a $100 switch. Okay, so now we talked about sharing in time and sharing in space. Okay, now there are hybrid concepts. Okay, why not share both in time and space? Okay, there are two ways to do this. Okay, one way is to share in space in two dimensions. Okay, not only share, suppose this is my crossbar, right? I have a bunch of interfaces and outputs, right? So I can have multi-space stages, okay? Multiple space division stages, okay? This is also sharing in space, but essentially you have one packet, it shows up at one stage and then goes to the other stage, and essentially you can have a pipeline of stages, okay? This is known as multi-stage architecture. Another more direct approach to combining space and time sharing is what is known as a space-time or time-space switch, okay, and modern telephone switches are of those form. Okay, we'll look at both of them in a minute. Okay, so basic idea is you want to be able to combine the advantages of each, right, the standard approach. Okay, if you have multiple advantages, I want the best of all worlds, I don't want the disadvantages of both worlds. Okay, of course you have to take some trade-offs. So the trade-off is that you'll not have parallel paths all the time. You'll have to accept some degree of non-blocking, some degree of blocking within the switch fabric. So Banyan switch design is a space, multi-stage space division switch. The features are that it is modular and scalable. You can build fairly large switches with it. And it's self-routing. What the self-routing means is that you don't need a centralized controller hanging on its head trying to schedule and set up all these things. So when packets themselves contain addressing information which route the packet through the switch. Okay, now the fancy thing which is happening now is that the switch itself is starting to look like a network. Remember that the switch itself is a component of the network which can connect multiple inputs to outputs, right, multiple nodes. A switch itself internally looks like a network because it has internal switching stages, and you have to route a packet to these switching stages. Okay, thankfully that routing is much simpler than internet routing. Okay, and it's actually very trivial. Okay, so basically each switch basically extracts one bit and figures out where I should send this packet. Right, or it extracts maybe 3 bits and figures out how to extend this packet. In fact, in a more recent traffic engineering design, we encoded for internet traffic engineering, we took a similar idea and said, let's take a few bits and figure out which route it needs to go to, interface IDs. Okay, this is done in the bananas architecture. So similar ideas from switching actually show up in routing as well. Okay, and then packet queues are possible within switching stages but not required. Okay, obviously the cost dramatically shoots up if you want to have packet queues. Okay, so the basic expensive component in multi-stage switches is the cross points. Okay, and you don't want to explode the number of cross points, so you have to share some cross points. Okay, you share these cross points over space and time. Okay, so the way Banyan switch fabric works, it's made up out of elemental crosspath switches. So the simplest crosspath switch is a 2-port switch. Okay, I have one input, one output. I mean, 2 inputs, 2 outputs. Okay. And I have a control bit which can be either 0 or 1. If the control bit is 0, the packet is switched over here. If the control bit is 1, the packet is switched here. Okay. So essentially you have a switching header. See, remember we used to talk about headers for packets, right? Now in addition to the entire packet, you also have a switching header which is what I meant by 0 or 1. Okay. So if I have a 64 by 64 switch, right, the switching header itself has to be multi-bit. Okay, so that when I come here, right, it should look at that multi-bit field, like the 8-bit field for a 64 by 64 switch, and then it has to tell me which output I have to go to. So I read those 6 bits and then figure out which output I need to go to. Okay, Not 8 bits, 6 bits. Okay, so now it turns out that you can have asynchronous Banyan designs and synchronous Banyan designs. And synchronous designs tend to be faster than the asynchronous designs because you can schedule exactly when you do the sharing. Okay, this is similar to, if you remember Aloha and slotted Aloha, when you study networking, in slotted Aloha, essentially the only trick you played was you made sure that the sharing would only occur, or the contention would only occur at boundaries called slot boundaries. Okay, now slot is same as synchronization. So essentially, if you synchronize, you can gain larger throughput, right? In Aloha and slotted Aloha, remember that maximum throughput of when you have random traffic, right, is you can double the capacity of Aloha using slotted Aloha. So exactly the same way, if I have random traffic showing up at the switches, and if I make the contention happen only at slot boundaries, magically the switch capacity doubles. Okay, so I'll not go into the same idea. Obviously, the worst case contention occurs when both these inputs want to go to the same output. Okay, now if I have multi-stage switch, this problem can occur at every stage, at every time slot. Okay, and in general, if I have multiple inputs which want to go to the same output, you might have blocking at some points internal to the crossbar. So trying to predict when blocking will occur, when blocking will not occur, and more broadly what is the blocking probability becomes a more complex problem. Okay, and by the way, these problems have been solved to some extent in the 1950s itself. In 1950s, there was a classic result by Close who showed that if you can arrange particular patterns of multi-stage switches to dramatically reduce the number of cross points, instead of having n square, you can have n times root n number of cross points, which is order of magnitude terms, it's much lesser, and you can have non-blocking. Okay, it turns out that Close, it still requires lots of cross points and people still make trade-offs, and we'll talk about that a little more. Okay, so a Banyan fabric. Okay, by the way, Banyan, the word comes from Banyan trees, okay, which have like all these roots hanging out of their stems and so on, right? So it's like lots of these interconnections. So Banyan essentially takes two these sort of simple building blocks, and then you interconnect them like this. Okay, so you start having these cross connections which go from one switch to other, and these elemental blocks can either be a 2-port or a 4-port, or in general we can have 64-port or 128-port switches. Okay, so I just wanted to show this to you. This is a simple 2-stage Banyan switch which is built up out of either smaller elements or a mix of small and big elements. Okay, we will look up switching and switching designs a little more carefully a little bit later. I just wanted to give you this as an overview of switching. So let's jump to an interesting problem called forwarding or lookup problem. Okay, this sometimes is also called port mapping problem. Port mapping essentially means a packet has showed up at an input port, I want to map it to an output port. So this is why it's called port mapping. Okay, and in our big picture diagram, this whole function occurs at the line card, input line card. Okay, so remember that input line card is not just a card, it has all it has fancy processing functions right here, and it also has memory. Okay, now this problem turns out to be very trivial in ATM or MPLS. Okay, it's much more complex in the other architectures, but in ATM or MPLS, essentially this problem is called direct lookup. I have an input virtual circuit ID which comes. It's a fixed length identifier. Okay, and I know where it is in the packet. Once I've synchronized the packet, I just pull out this identifier and do a direct match in a table memory, and then output comes, tells me which is my output port, and it also tells me what is the swap. Okay, what should I swap this label with? Okay, so it's a direct match problem. So direct matching can be done through hashing or indexing or lots of techniques. Okay, so data structures for direct matching are extremely trivial. So you can just use standard random access memory and use the do direct matching. Okay, now if I look at bridges and Ethernet switches, right, what do they do? When a packet comes in, right, they will take the 48-bit destination address, and then they need to see if this, they try to do a direct match of this destination address in a table. Remember that Ethernet switching just looks up the destination frame address or layer 2 address. It does not do any fancy, longest prefix match or any such stuff. It's a flat address, and I can direct look up flat address. Okay, now what you do in Ethernet is instead of looking up a 48-bit address, right, the probability that, so if I don't want to have a 48-bit memory here, so what I meant is that I don't want to have wide access line to memory. That's number one. The other one is that it is not likely that my LAN will have 2 to the power of 48 nodes. Okay, 48 bits are for all the LAN cards in the world. Okay, it's not likely that all of them will lie in your LAN. So this table is likely to be very small, right? So what you do is you take this 48 bits, and essentially you can do an associative lookup, okay, which is the sort of lousy way to do it. I mean, so you can just look up in an associative memory or what is known as content addressable memory. Okay, I'll tell what these things are a little bit later. But then you get a hit or a miss. Okay, now this turns out to be very expensive because you don't want to build large associative memories or content addressable memories. Okay, you might have studied associative memories when you studied caches and TLBs and these sorts of things in computer architecture. So these are memory which allows you to do multiple lookups at the same time. See, normally random access memory, right, you take a pack, you take an address and you just look up that address randomly. That address could be random, right? But associative means you will give you a bunch of addresses and you look up them simultaneously. Okay, now the key thing is the way it is done is you look up typically at one point, and but you get a whole bunch of data together. So in that sense, if you look up one address, you get a bunch of data together. That's what associative is. Content addressable means that, I'll explain a little more data. You need a diagram to explain it. You can not only look up one thing, you can also look up an array of elements which are associated with that. That's what it's called, content addressable. Okay, but this process gets enormously complicated. People were trying to build switches early on in late 80s. They realized that this is not the way to go. Okay, so this is simple, but it's expensive. But they want it cheap. Today, cheap Ethernet switches are available. How do they do it? They do it by a simple technique known as hashing. Okay, now we use hashing in several ideas in networking. Okay, now later when we learn bananas architecture for traffic engineering, that's one way we use hashing. Hashing is used in other several contexts. Okay, so hashing is used to speed up lookup. Okay, so I take a 48-bit quantity and then develop a 16-bit hash. Okay, and then I look for the 16-bit hash in memory. Okay, this is what I do. Obviously, there is a probability that there'll be some collisions here. Okay, but if I have a reasonably good hash function, that probability of collisions will be low, and it'll also be well distributed. Okay, so one simple way of getting a 16-bit hash is to just do a CRC. Okay, if you remember CRC, right? CRC or it's a cyclic redundancy check. It's used for checking for errors. Okay, there what you try to do is, if the CRC fails, you know it's an errored packet and so on, right? But CRC also turns out to be a hash function. So what you can do is you can just take standard CRC 16, which can be implemented in hardware hash function. And when I snoop for a source address, I can take the source address, do a CRC 16 and dump it into memory. And when a destination address comes, I can do a hash, same CRC 16, and check if it's in memory. So this turns out to be enormously fast, and it also requires only 16-bit memory, which is available today. And ask for hit or miss. Okay. Now it is possible that you can have collisions, and you can build a small linked list here to handle collisions. Okay, this is all standard hashing ideas. Okay. Now it turns out that people have done analysis of how fast these lookups are, etc. Okay. So basically, it has this kind of Ethernet-like curve. It basically shoots up exponentially after a point. So essentially, if I have the average number of references, that is the number of collisions, right, starts shooting up dramatically after a point. Okay, I will not get into that. But essentially, these are all these exponential curves which you saw in Ethernet. If you keep the operation point well below that, you will pretty much not have collisions, etc. Okay, so the lookups using hashing, the advantages are that it's simple. Expected lookup time can be very small, and the disadvantages is that the lookup time is somewhat non-deterministic. When a packet shows up, you might have to actually traverse those linked lists. And from a memory usage point of view, you cannot pack all the memory very efficiently. Okay, so you need to have this 2 to the power of 16 memory, and you need random access. A lot of memory can be wasted. Okay, all this is fine because memory has become cheap. See, as I told, see the right trade-offs, are the following. I mean, size of memory is not a problem. You can get lots of memory today. If you can get a computer with a gigabyte of memory or something like that, right? So you can get memory which are fairly large, but access time to memory is the problem. Okay, so access times don't get faster and faster. So what you can do is you can waste something that's cheap. You can waste things that are actually, you can actually waste a lot more memory and use the memory inefficiently, no problem. Okay, as long as you keep the accessing thing operation simple, that's why we used a 16-bit hash rather than a 48-bit lookup. Okay, so that is about ATM and Ethernet. So that's how layer 2 switches are built. That's the lookup problem in layer 2. Now, if you come to layer 3, which is IP, now the lookup is not so simple. Lookup is not just taking the IP address or hashing it and then trying to look it up directly. You have to do what is known as a longest prefix match. Okay, in the most trivial case, what it means is that you have to find all the prefixes that match in the table and then take the longest one. Okay, and in the worst case, this can be order n, where n is the number of entries in the table. Okay, so, and as I told, in big routers today, you have 100,000 entries in the table. You don't want to have an operation that basically goes and accesses memory 100,000 times, right? If you do that, each memory access, even if it's SRAM, takes at the best 5 nanoseconds. 100,000 means 500,000 nanoseconds. You don't have budget of that time. You have only 30 nanoseconds to switch the packet out. Okay, you have 50 nanoseconds probably to switch a packet out. You can't spend 500,000 nanoseconds, right? Just looking up the packet. So lookup has to be made fast, okay? So that is the fundamental problem. So as I said, lookup, then you not only do lookup, you also manipulate the packet header like decrement, TTL, etc., and then send it off. So the first architectural innovation that is done is to have cached addresses. Okay, just like we had hashing is a form of caching also. I mean, so when you have a forwarding table, right, which is formed by OSPF or something like that, you can cache that part of the forwarding table that is relevant to you. Okay, so for example, you can have onboard or on-chip memory where if a packet comes, right, it is likely that another packet will show up pretty soon with the same destination address, right? So if you have done a lookup recently for that, you might as well cache it in high-speed memory, right? So this is standard caching ideas, locality of reference, okay, temporal locality of reference. But the locality of reference sort of, it's not as high as it's in simple computers, okay? In simple computers, because programs are little linearly, it's very, very high locality of reference, I mean like 95-99%, okay? Whereas in networking, typically a flow contains about 10 packets or so, okay? So there is some degree of locality of reference, but not too much, okay? But still there exists locality of reference, so you should get every ounce you can from that. So line cards have their own memory, okay? And they don't go to the CPU or the main forwarding table, okay? So they cache their own piece of the forwarding table here. Okay, so let's see. So when a packet comes here, you can go just look up locally and shuttle it out, okay, without even touching this central CPU. Okay, this is known as the fast path. Okay, and then if you go through the CPU for whatever reason, that's known as the slow path. So the idea, just like caching, is when you have a miss, you go through the slow path. When you have a hit, you go through the fast path. Okay, so as I said, people have studied hit rates in terms of network caches, and they found that even though it's not as impressive as the computers, you need larger caches. Okay, unlike computers you can keep very small caches and still get away with it, but here you need much larger caches, like 10% of the full table you need the cache size, and the hit rate basically tops off at around 80-85%. I mean, it does get this thing, but then this is actually a logarithmic plot, so you need lots more cache if you want to cache more. Okay, and so building, if you want to build large memories, if you want to put it on chip, it gets costly. Okay, so very SRAM, fast SRAM and large SRAM is still costly. So you try to minimize the size of the cache too, to some extent. Oops, sorry. I don't know why this come out like this. So let's just go to the next one. So essentially what you do here is that now it's not just about the cache. Okay, cache means that I take a bunch of forwarding entries and put it locally. Okay, now I not only need to maintain it locally inside the line card, but I need to organize it in a fancy way so that the number of operations or number of memory accesses I do within the cache is minimized. Okay, it's not like you just check out the cache once and get the destination address, right? You can't get a match. You might have to look at all the cache entries in the worst case, right? So you have to be much more fanciful than that. So you have the cache itself is organized in a fancy data structure, okay, and that is important. And probably that's the main innovation that has happened in terms of IP lookup. Okay, so to understand what the issue is, let's look at this diagram. So usually if I have a destination prefix, right, like 65.0.0.8, okay, what it means is that this prefix actually spans a subspace of the entire address space, right. If I give you a 32-bit field, I can have an address space that spans 2 to the power of 32, right. And now if I take a slash 8, it means that it's a piece of that address space. And in fact, I can, not only it's a piece of the address space of this given size, it also lies right here. It's an address space, subspace of size 2 to the power of 24, and any prefix that comes here, any destination address that matches this should lie in the subspace. That's exactly what a match means, okay, or a prefix match means. Okay, now we have to, so we are trying to understand what a prefix match is, and then we'll understand what a longest prefix match is, right. Okay, so this prefix length determines the size, and when a prefix shows up, like suppose, see, usually packets don't show up with prefixes, they show up with the actual full destination addresses. So suppose I have a packet that shows up with a destination address of 128.9.16.14, okay, essentially that is a single point in this address space, right. And when I say it matches a prefix, it means that this point is covered by this range, address range. That's what a prefix match means. Okay, so essentially what I mean is that this destination address is matching this prefix. Okay, this is obvious by looking at this table, but this is what it means diagrammatically, right. Now this diagram actually helps us a lot. It helps us design data structures which can help you do this prefix match or longest prefix match very efficiently. Let's see how. Prefixes can overlap. That is why you need longest prefix match. Otherwise, you don't. If they don't overlap, you don't need longest prefix match. So suppose I have the same destination address which shows up. It can match this prefix. It can match this prefix, and it can also match this prefix. Okay, because this space over here, which is slash 21 space, overlaps this slash 16 space. Okay, and this 16 space overlaps this slash 32 space. Right. So I have this destination address which is slash 32, it shows up here, it matches the slash 16 as well as the slash 21. Okay. If I have a prefix which shows up here, it will match the slash 16, it will match slash 21 and the slash 24. Okay, it will match multiple prefixes. Okay, so the routing lookup, I mean, is essentially to find the longest match, that is the highest thing over here. Okay, and it's also sometimes called most specific route, okay, or most specific prefix. Okay, this is also lingo which is used in the internet world among all the prefixes that match the destination address. Okay, this is the diagrammatic way of understanding. Now how can we use this? Okay, now what we can do is we can view this matching problem rather than a one dimensional problem. See what we did earlier. Oops, what did I do? Do you know which slide I was in? What is that? 60 something, huh? Sorry. Okay, so here, I wanted to go back here a little bit. So if I do the naive thing, right, I essentially view this this table as a one-dimensional array, and I go to every element and check. It's basically sequential search. So that is one way of doing search. Okay. Go. Move. Okay. Another way to view it is view this matching problem as a two-dimensional matching problem. Okay, essentially you are not only matching on the prefix value, but you are also matching on the prefix length. That is why that slash part is important, right? And essentially I do this diagram earlier, right? And I drew these slash 21s at a higher reach than the slash 16, and the slash 16 was higher than slash 32, right? And these were also located differently in this horizontal axis. So the x-axis you can view as prefix values, and the y-axis you can view as prefix length, right? So essentially you need to match both the length as well as value. So what you do is you basically change the game. Instead of trying to match on value, you try to first match on length. Okay, that's essentially what you do. Okay, so overall, after you do all this fancy data structure, you want to measure it through some metrics. The lookup time is one metric which we are primarily concerned about, but we are also concerned about other metrics like storage time, etc. Okay. So, and remember, just to give you a reminder on lookup rates, my budget, I need to forward so much, I have about, if I want to forward at 31 million packets per second for OC192C, it means that I have a budget of 33 nanoseconds. Okay, and remember that DRAM, off-the-shelf DRAM is 50 nanoseconds. So I can't even do one single DRAM access at the speed. So I have to use SRAM, right? Okay, so not only is the lookup speed important, I might also need to update this. Okay, it turns out that BGP maintains tables of size 100,000. And not only is the table of size 100,000, it's not static table. It keeps changing all the time. When routing algorithms keep changing their routing binding associations, you have to continue, you have to go and change your route forwarding table. So this can affect cache hit rates, etc., right? So update rates can be up to hundreds of routes per second. Hundreds of routes out of the 10,000 routes can change, okay? And this, if you study internet protocols, we look at these graphs more carefully, that we show how the graph of number of updates changes over time. Okay, people are trying to work on these things to try to reduce, put a lid on the number of updates and so on, but you still have to be prepared for a future where you have lots of bursty updates. You have hundreds of routes suddenly changed or thousands of routes change. Okay, actually what happened was there was, some of you might remember, there was a code red worm attack, okay, in the internet. Okay, now this was not targeted at routers. It was targeted at some sort of usual bug of Microsoft. Okay, so it was targeting that and you're doing some kind of a port scan. But as a side effect, it started like messing up router caches. And once the router caches started getting messed up, it affected, the data plane got messed up. Okay, the data plane affected control plane got messed up and it sent huge numbers of updates. Okay, and it basically brought down part of the internet. Okay, and so these kinds of weird interactions can occur. So bursty updates can occur, and you want to be able to, so that you don't want the router to go down because of all such weird attacks. Okay, so another thing, the size of the forwarding table itself can grow, or the size of the cached part of the forwarding table. So around the late 90s, everybody was paranoid and really worried about how fast the internet is growing. Okay, and especially the routing tables. Okay, the number of prefixes were growing roughly at around 10,000 prefixes per year. This linear growth was largely attributed to the success of the CIDR mechanism in the internet. Okay, BGP4 provides a mechanism called classless interdomain routing, okay, which allows you to aggregate prefixes and have just aggregated prefixes in the routing table, and that slowed down the growth of routing tables. But suddenly people started multi-homing their enterprises. Like RPA, for example, has connections to two ISPs, and RPA announces its own autonomous system number to the outside world. So like that, every .com which boomed during this time had its own autonomous system number and started announcing this. So the number of routing table entries as well as autonomous system numbers started growing exponentially. Okay, what this meant was routing tables will also start growing exponentially. So one of the requirements on routing tables was to be able to support larger and growing routing tables. So today's big routers, which I showed you in the first slides, can support more than 500,000 routes or up to 1,000,000 routing table entries. Remember, I told you that today's in practice today the number of routing entries are about 100,000. But routers have already increased to capacity where they can support 1,000,000 routes. Okay, and people were really, really worried about this problem, about whether the routing tables will grow even faster than Moore's law, and we can't keep up with this. But thankfully, the .com has been busted, and it's not growing less fast. Okay, so sometimes things are good, right? Okay, so that's why demand for routers is also reduced. Okay, that's a side effect. Now, so the fancy data structure I mentioned to you, right, was to use a tree. Okay, now a variant of a tree. Okay, remember what a tree does? Tree does comparison operations at every hop, and it says that, okay, let me compare to see if it's greater than or less than. Remember this binary search, right? You can do binary search on the x-axis. So when I have a table, right, I can sort the table and I can do binary search on the sorted table, right? Or I can do another fancy thing. I can do binary search on y-axis. Remember, I have prefix sizes, right? And the longest prefix match means that I need to go to the bottom of this this tree. Okay, this tree is called a fancy name. It's called tri, T-R-I-E rather than T-R-E. Okay, but it's just a tree. It's a tree on the y-axis. That's all it is. Okay, so here it's log n, but here you're talking about log n in terms of log of 32 rather than log of 2 to the power of 32, right? So you have much smaller tree here. So that is the major innovation. Okay, so people started considering tries or variants of it's known as patricia trees and so on. And then one major thing that was done was, instead of having just a two-way try or a balanced binary try, you can have multi-way tries. So at any hop, you since memory access are the costly things, when you access memory, try to match as much as you can. You do use associative matching. So you can have a 16-way retry, which is indexed by 4 bits. And if I want to go to 32 bits, right, I just have to have 3 levels or 4 levels. So I need 4 memory accesses if I have 16-way tries. Okay. So as I said, even each memory access is like 5 nanoseconds, right? Things nanoseconds add up. Okay. So at least now I've come, instead of trying to do 100,000 accesses, I've come down to 4 accesses just by using 16-way retry, okay, 16-way search tree. So obviously you can go even further, right? You can do a 32-way or like, I mean, you get bigger wins only if you're able to double this number, like, actually double this bit space. So if I, instead of doing 4, I can do 8 matching, so it'll reduce the number of levels. Okay, so essentially people try to take this to the extreme. Multi-way tries, suppose I increase the degree of the try from 2, 4, all the way to 256, essentially the trade-off is the following. I use a lot more memory, okay? But it turned out that the total memory used was not a big deal. Just it's like 64 megabytes, okay? You can get today's, I mean, you can get 64 megabytes on a handheld, right? So it's not a big deal. So but what you did was, I wasted a lot of memory, but I reduced the number of memory references. So here's a classic way of how you do trade-offs. You find that thing which is really, really costly, identify that, okay, and don't have illusions about what is costly. What is costly is not memory. Memory access is costly. So waste money on buying lots of memory, even lots of SRAM if necessary, and try to minimize the number of references to that by organizing what is in memory through fancy data structure. So remember, you don't design data structures just for the heck of it. You design data structures to meet a trade-off. Okay, so the trade-off here is to reduce memory references. And you can, essentially, if you look at the thing here, it looked like a colossal waste of memory. 99.5% of memory is wasted. Okay, just to give you an idea. Okay, but remember, it's good to waste something that's cheap to optimize something that's costly. Okay. So essentially another thing that was done is you try to leverage statistics to optimize it further. See, if you can build a 256-way try, essentially that means it's not the 16 thing, right? So instead of 16-way, I do 256-way try, which means 8 bits here, right? So if I have 8 bits, just 4 levels, I can reach 32 bits, right? So now I want to do better. I don't want even 4 accesses to memory. I want to do even better. What I can do is I can leverage the patterns of addresses or patterns of address prefixes that are available. So if I look at the distribution, this is why we study probability. Okay, people hate probability when we teach it in our courses. Okay, but probability helps you optimize, right? So I have a real problem here and I want to reduce the number of accesses, right? So what I can do is I just observe that most prefixes are not large prefixes. Most prefixes are 24 bits or smaller. Okay, this is a distribution, right? If you look at this part, right, add up all the stuff of this probability distribution, there's nothing here, okay, very less. Most of them are 24 bits or smaller. So what I do is I get 2 to the power of 24 memory, okay, I don't even bother about this try business. Just get 2 to the power of 24 memory and just put all the prefixes possible there and have 2 hardware stages, okay, and try to do an associative match to get a match in this, okay, the most likely match. If that fails, I'll make one extra access. So the common case, I'll just make one memory access. So remember, I've optimized this whole thing from 500,000 memory accesses, right, or 500,000 nanoseconds actually, to one memory access, right? It's quite incredible. Okay, so the way it is done today is like this. Okay, so essentially you take this IP prefix, which comes 32 bits. You just ignore it. You just leverage statistics to know that 24 bits are most important. Just look it up directly. Okay, see if you get a match. If you get a match, then at the same time, you also look up, the remaining 4 bits. So, excuse me. So, you have an offset, this which is also there. And you form the next hop and to get out to it. So it is possible that you can have a longer match than 24 bits. Okay, now that is done through slow path. If that happens, right, this whole thing is preempted. And so this is the fast path. The slow path, you do a full longer match. Okay, and the longer match is implemented as tries. So we saw that even though tries dramatically reduce the number of matches, even that is done in slow path. Okay, so slow path hardware is it's still much heavily optimized. And essentially, you're doing the brute force thing here. Okay, so that is a quick rundown of what are the major things people do in terms of hardware design to just do the simple problem of look up a packet to figure out where it has to go. Okay, and the lookup problem is extremely trivial in ATM. That's why people thought label switching would take off. Okay, but then just because something is complex doesn't mean you can't do it fast. Okay, so there was a lot of innovations around mid-90s, especially in terms of data structure and hardware design, to come up with extremely fast routers. And even though this whole thing is complex, right, it can be done at comparable cost. Okay, so once people have figured it out, you can build hardware and essentially run volumes of it and get cost down. So high-speed routers have been possible primarily, one of the big reasons they've been possible is because you can do lookup fast. Okay, and another thing which people do is they take existing ATM switch fabrics. Switching is the other part of the puzzle, right, of high-speed router. You do lookup using this high-speed, this new algorithm, okay, and caching and all these other fancy data structure designs. But for the forwarding, right, that is the switching fabric, you just borrow ATM fabric. So you can take an existing ATM hardware, throw out its lookup algorithm, design your own line card for it, okay, and internally you just chop up an IP packet into ATM cells and forward it through the ATM fabric, okay, and then at the output you just recombine it and send it out. So people have leveraged ATM fabrics to build IP routers. Okay, obviously in more recent routers you don't do even that. I mean, you can directly switch IP packets. Okay, but so essentially the line between MPLS and IP, pure IP forwarding or IP over SONET, PPP over SONET, dramatically blurred around mid-90s, where people started showing that you can build these hardwares. Okay, and over the next few years, people have been trying to actually increase the scale of that hardware in all dimensions, right? So we'll study some of the more modern issues of, okay, suppose I really want to take it to, that major breakthrough was known as gigabit forwarding, okay, gigabit per second switches or supporting a 50 gigabit per second or more aggregate throughput was a big deal. Okay, in fact, one of the reference articles which I point you to and might require you to read later is how to build a 50 gigabit per second router. Okay, that was a paper published as late as 97, but it's essentially work that was done in the early 90s to show what were the issues people faced in trying to get this problem solved and what were the trade-offs at those times. Very fascinating read. Okay, so, but after that, it's become trivial. Okay, so people essentially went on the same technology curve to optimize it further and further. Now we are facing even more problems when we go from gigabit or hundreds of gigabits to terabits. So terabit routers or 10 terabit or 100 terabit routers are much more fancy, again, today. Okay, it's become harder to solve them. Okay, so people are doing some mix of optics and some interesting technologies. I'll cover that in the end of this lecture. Okay, so let's get back to the switching part of the puzzle. We overviewed the simple ideas in switching, like space switching, time switching, some combinations of them, especially multi-stage Banyan, right? So there's more to Banyan than just what I talked about. Okay, so let's talk about really larger, higher speed. Let's push the envelope. Okay, so IP routers have evolved over generations. Okay, the first generation was looked pretty much like a computer. Okay, so in a computer, you have a CPU and you have line interface, right? And you have all this monitor and this interesting form factor. So what you can do is you can give up the form factor and essentially build a form factor that's, you can plug in a lot of interfaces, line cards. Okay, have the same bus, same CPU. Okay, and build a router. Okay, so essentially you have line interface, and instead of putting the DMA, the direct memory access in the CPU, you move the DMA to the line interface. That was the only major thing that was changed. Okay, but the bus is still arbitrated using the usual mechanism. All the main memory forwarding tables are all stored here. Okay, so costly thing was the bus, okay, and this was what was the first generation router, and CPU would be like another card in this puzzle. Okay, so you'd have to go through access memory all the time and come back. Okay, so you needed two accesses to the bus and it will be slow. Second generation routers, essentially you figure out which is the bottleneck and try to eliminate it. So if memory is a bottleneck, what you do is you move some of the memory to local line cards, right? So you essentially have created parallel memory. So each memory is accessed independently, right? So here, instead of going to central memory, you go through this cached. So this was the basic idea of bringing a cache of the forwarding table to local memory. This was available in second generation routers itself. In the third generation routers, you recognize that the bus has now become a bottleneck. You replace that bus with a, which is a single data path with multiple data paths, which is essentially a switch fabric. Okay. Now, so packets would go through this, you would make the forwarding decision here, and it's possible for you to have multiple simultaneous forwarding or data paths possible. Okay, in second generation that was not possible. So switch fabric innovation happened. Now fourth generation, you have, the problem is that it's a mix of power, space and speed. Okay, all these are issues. I remember I told you the power trade-off is there, space trade-off is there. So today's routers look like this. Okay, essentially this all the switching has become extremely small. It is possible for you to become make switching or even multi-stage switching or extremely high-speed switching. If you want to do something really high-speed, you have to make it very small. This is the rule of thumb in hardware. Okay, if you study computer architecture, this is the first thing they teach you. If you want to make something fast, make it small. Okay, and make it simple. Right, only then you can make it small. So it turned out that interfaces, right, has to do all these fancy things. It has to like do links, frame synchronization. It has to do, I mean, it has to support all kinds of junk, right? I mean, Sonnet, it has to support WDM, or it depends upon what interface you're talking about, right? So an interface usually has a whole bunch of electronics and so on, right? But even that I'm talking about, I'm saying that these are also shrinking. Okay, but when people come, try to push the curve in terms of interfaces, usually they are a full motherboard. Okay, so you need a whole, I wish I had these interfaces with me, but I can show you. So essentially these are almost like this half foot or 1 foot across. They're very thin, okay, but they have lots of electronics in them. Okay, once people have figured that out, within a couple of years, you'll have the same thing which is so small. Okay, essentially you miniaturize the whole thing, reduce the functions, and you have chipsets which integrate many of these functions into one chip. Okay, this is the standard way hardware proceeds. But still, you have these lot of interfaces. You have interfaces themselves stored in clusters or racks. And then from these interfaces, you connect fibers, okay, locally to switching elements. And this, a single rack or a single sort of sub-rack will contain the entire switch. Okay, so packets come on interfaces. They will go on these fibers to the switches. They'll get switched. They'll come back here and then get out. So this whole thing is a router. Right, so instead of actually building a single rack, rack space has become important, right? So you actually have racks of just interfaces, and you have these, this is called clustering. Okay, so this, now you're talking about multi-stage in terms of just racking or space management. Okay, and by the way, you have a constraint. This whole thing cannot be more than 30 meters or 100 feet. So when you go to POPs, right, you'll have this entire set of this thing, right? I mean, you have all these racks just of interfaces mostly. Okay, and this is where the router vendors make money off, okay, because this is where all the money is. Okay, the switch fabrics and these chassis are all almost given away. Okay, so let's move on. So we need to understand what is the difference in switching telephony versus what is switching in terms of switching packets, right? Primary goal in general is to maximize capacity, right? I want switching capacity in terms of aggregate data rate, or aggregate sort of slot rate for time division switching. I want to maximize capacity. For circuits which I have an additional goal, I want to minimize call blocking. So remember that telephony doesn't just come in terms of those 8-bit samples. It comes in terms of calls. So when a call comes, I should have a path which I need to set up, and I need to nail down that path forever, okay, as long as that call exists. So, and call blocking is a problem. So I need to somehow minimize the call blocking rates. And remember, if I since I'm going to nail down a path for this call, right, and this time slot especially, if I build a multi-stage switch, I do have a non-trivial internal blocking probability. So internal blocking and all these other things start adding up and actually affecting call blocking rates. So if I want to have 99.997 call blocking rates throughout the network, this means I need to have an even better call blocking rates at every switch on the network. So remember that normally a call goes through multiple switches to reach from your phone to the other's phone. So you need pretty high non-blocking rates at switches. Okay, so call blocking must be minimized. Okay, that is one important thing. So the granularity is at the call level. At a packet switch, if you don't have this call notion, but you need to minimize packet loss. So you will have buffers and all these other things. Here there's no buffering problem. Okay, so you have to minimize packet loss here. And also the other constraint usually is that you don't want to reorder packets. See, this reordering constraint actually avoids, means that you cannot leverage. The reordering constraint actually comes from TCP. If you remember TCP, it has a congestion control mechanism called fast retransmit. If three packets come out of order, it will assume that a packet has been lost. Okay, so you cannot reorder more than three packets, which means every switch cannot reorder more than one packet. If it goes through three switches which reorder one packet, you will immediately get three reordered packets, right? So essentially, basically, the thing is that you cannot reorder packets at all. So that is one of the huge constraints on switches. So if you look at McNeon's slides, who designs real switches, he says if only people allow me to reorder packets, I can build much faster switches, just because I can get the parallelism. So it restricts how much parallelism you can get out. Circuit switches, basic idea is I need to handle a lot of calls simultaneously. So in practice, we're talking about some hundreds of thousands of calls. So about 200,000 calls, let's talk about that. Okay, so for all these calls, I have to move samples from input to output, and samples have no headers, remember. And destination of that sample is completely dependent upon the time. So it's completely timing driven. And in practice, input trunks are multiplexed. So it's not only from input to output, an input itself is time shared, right? I need to be able to extract a time slot from the input, send it to output, and map it to a time slot at the output. So it's both sharing across time and space from input to output. Okay, so essentially the function is straightforward. You need to extract the samples from a frame, and you have to switch it to output, and that operation depends upon the position within the frame. Everything is determined by the position. Okay, and then once you get to the output, you have to put in the right slot. So call blocking occurs when you cannot find a path from input to output nailed down. And as I said, you can have several reasons for this. You can have internal blocking, that is the switching fabric blocks, or you can have output blocking, which means that the output runs slowly. Okay, that's what it means. Whenever you say blocking, it means that something doesn't run fast enough, or you share it. Okay. So I think this review is a little bit of what we already done. One simple way to do switching is to just do multiplexing and demultiplexing. So this doesn't actually switch effectively, but remember that a multiplexer takes this bunch of inputs, combines them into a larger input. Okay, this is a much faster running bus, and then you just demultiplex it, you get this. Okay, now actually, I talked about time space thing, right? Okay, time division switching, right, or a time slot interchanger. Between this mux and demux, it just adds a shuffle element called a time slot interchanger. Okay, that together, these three things will achieve a switching function. And we saw crossbar earlier, it's a space division. Circuit switch essentially combines both these ideas. It combines the notion of space division as well as time division. Okay, so the goal, as I said again, is to support large number of calls. And I can't just do a space division switch for so many calls, okay, because I need millions of cross points. Okay, so call blocking, I think we discussed all this stuff. So the scaling issue is the following. I just can't build a time division switch that can handle 200,000 circuits, because the problem is that memory is not fast. See, this is a simple problem. If memory were fast, if alone DRAM access speeds had been fast, I wouldn't have to design all these fancy switch architectures. I just take DRAM, access it fast, and just build a shared memory architecture switch, right? Why build all this complexity? It would become even much more easier. But unfortunately, DRAM is not fast. Okay, so if I want to switch so many circuits, I'll have to make accesses at the order of 0.5 nanoseconds, and nothing is available. Current technology, this book was written in 97. Obviously, even today, you can't get that speeds. So you need to compensate for that speed mismatch using fancy stuff, right? So you can do space division or time division switching. And space division, we talked about crossbar or multi-stage crossbar. So so here you see an interesting crossbar design, which is called the closed architecture, where you have some particular type of crossbar here and a different type of crossbar here and a different type of crossbar here. So it's like 10 cross 3 and 3 cross 10. It's just a reverse crossbar here. And here I have a 2 cross 2. Okay, these are defined by a bunch of parameters. And close proved that if I have this kind of a three-state switch, it is non-blocking. And it's the It's the smallest switch that is non-blocking. In other words, it has the minimum number of cross points to get you non-blocking, okay, in a multi-stage architecture. But the, as I said, the key problem in multi-stage is that you have to sort of shuttle these time samples across these things in a synchronous fashion, and you have to rearrange connections at each of these stages at every switching time. Okay, now even if you do this closed architecture, which is described a little more in the textbook, you still need a lot of cross points. If I wanted to switch 120,000 calls, right, you still need about 250 million cross points, okay, even after doing multi-stage. Remember, if I do single stage, it is like 120,000 multiplied by 120,000, okay, that just explodes. But even with the multi-stage switch, if I just want to do non-blocking, this is the constraint for non-blocking. So people, what they do is, okay, they said, okay, I don't want so many cross points, but I'm willing to live with a small non-blocking probability. So it is possible for you to start trading off the blocking probability and then dramatically reduce this. Okay, so like acceptable values are like 50 million or 100 million or 10 million cross points are okay. So you need to like cut this down by about 2 orders of magnitude, and then you're doing fine. So you have two ways of doing that: either just by accepting higher non-blocking probability, or by building even more fancier switches. Okay. Now, essentially, the fancier type of switch you build is what is known as a time-space switching. Okay. Now, this is actually very simple. What you do is you take a crossbar, and you put a time slot interchanger in front of it. So that's why it's called time-space. You first do a TSI or times switching here, and then you put a space switching here. Okay. That's why it's called time-space switching. Okay. Now you can take this further, and you call it a time-space time switching. Means that you put a TSI in front and a TSI outside, and you put a space division switch here. Okay, don't try to think through all the details of this. Just in a block diagram fashion, just think about how the simplicity of this. TSI you understood, and you understood crossbar, right? If I put a time space time interchanger here and time interchanger output, it turns out that just by this design, you dramatically reduce, almost by one order of magnitude, you can reduce for the same non-blocking probability. So if I take a commercial telephone switch like the 5EASS, remember this is used in the central offices, or the 4EASS and so on are used in toll and tandem switching. These fellows essentially use the same architecture. They use TT and then they put multiple space stages. Okay, what they did was they took the closed architecture I told you, the multi-stage Banyan switch over here, SSS, right? So it will have multiple 3-stage Banyan. And then they'll put a T in front of and 3 in back. That's it. In fact, if you look at some more sophisticated or higher capacity lower blocking switches, they'll add one more S in between. Okay. So from a conceptual viewpoint, essentially it's a question of taking a brute force, taking a time slot interchanger at the ends and beginning and add several space division stages in between. Okay. So there are limits on how far you can go with this, okay, and Bellamy's book actually goes into more detail of this. We'll not go into any more detail of this stuff. That's all I want to say about circuit switches. Remember that multi-stage switching is itself a form of time switching, but this TST is a more explicit way of combining time and space switching. Okay. Now, okay, so that was for synchronous circuit switches. In packet switches, you're not interested in supporting so many calls, you're interested in actually increasing packet switching rate or aggregate packet rate. Okay, so here it involves assuming that the destination port has been looked up on the fly, and once you have that, you have a small switching header that you carry through this batch of Banyan network. Okay, now what is that? We have to talk about it. So what is the concept of blocking in packet switches? You can have internal blocking as usual, or you can have output blocking. Okay, and pretty much most switches, packet switches are input queued. They have lots of queues of the input, and essentially to handle blocking. If a packet is blocked, you have to put it in a buffer. If you can't put it in a buffer, you have to drop it. Okay, so preferably you don't want to drop packets just because it's blocked. Okay, so you typically put it in buffers. Okay, and you essentially leverage the statistics of the thing. I mean, it's not likely to be blocked forever, right? You're likely to get through. The probability of blocking for the same interface from all interfaces is very low. Okay, so these are the kinds of statistics. So this is what is called statistical sharing. So you try to leverage the statistics and to reduce the total number of components you do. Okay, so how to deal with blocking? And these are the sort of usual suspects. Okay, so if you want to deal with blocking, first try to provision more. Okay, try to have more space stages or try to provision more capacity. If you can't do that, put more buffers. If you can't put more buffers, then you provide some back pressure. Okay, tell the previous switches or previous elements of the stage not to send you more. Okay, so this way you can use back pressure in combination with some output queuing. Or you can build like very complex parallel switch fabrics. Okay, so one sort of simple way you can do crossbars is that every element of the cross point you can put a buffer. Okay, this turns out to be incredibly costly, so people don't do this. Okay, so and these packets also tend to do so. This buffer essentially the way it does is it sits in this buffer sometime, and then the next packet comes and it also contends with the input. Okay, so anyway, that is not done. Okay, so Banyan we saw earlier. Okay, Banyan essentially the way it is organized is you have multiple stages and they are interconnected in some fancy way. Okay, this interconnection is also a regular interconnection, which means that there is a method to this madness. Okay, so so what happens is that when a packet comes which says that I want to go to this output 111, okay, first it will go from here to here, and then it will go from here to here, and then it will go from here to here. Okay, and this 1, the input 1 will be, see 111 is 3 bit, right? The first bit of the input will be used to guide the packet from here to here. Okay, because this output is labeled 0, this output is labeled 1. So you can essentially extract bits from the switch packet header to guide the packet through the switching fabric. So that's why it's called self-routing. Self-routing also means that there's no central controller. Okay. So and that's how the whole thing is arranged. So the features of a multi-stage switch is that instead of having lots of switching elements, you have far fewer switching elements. So you can basically do the math, and you have far fewer switching elements if I have multiple stages than if I build a sort of mammoth crossbar. Okay. So what else? And the whole thing is regular, right? There's a clear method to this madness, and it's fairly regular. So the whole thing can be realized in VLSI, which means you can get a switching chip. A single chip can give you, or you can buy what are known as 64x64 crossbars. Okay, or you can buy even larger crossbars, those are more costly. A smaller crossbar is obviously cheaper, but you prefer medium size or larger ones. Okay, so the way you avoid blocking or deal with blocking in the Banyan fabric is, you cannot avoid internal blocking. So there is some residual probability of internal blocking. Suppose I have random traffic, right? There's no way you can avoid the fact that you can have multiple outputs, multiple inputs destined to the same output. Can't do that. Okay, but unless you do something to the input. Okay, so if the input is truly random, then you can't avoid this thing. But then you can try do some fancy things. Okay, you can essentially set up what is known as a knockout tournament. Okay, this is known as a knockout switch. So you can have a three-phase. It's like a tennis tournament where you try to have one stage of the tournament, and if you fail in that stage, you'll get dropped, right? And next, you go to the next stage of the tournament. If you fail in that stage, you'll get dropped, and the winner of the tournament passes through. So the idea is that the expectation is that tournaments will be small, and you don't drop too many packets, and you sort of spread packet losses across interfaces fairly. Okay, so it's knockout switch essentially says that I build a blocking Banyan fabric and then set up a knockout type thing. This, and people have analyzed this knockout business, and then they found that this sort of fairly distributes the average loss probability. Okay, of course, if you can buffer this thing, I can, even if I get knocked out of a tournament, I can be knocked out to a buffer. Okay, only if the buffer overflows, I'll be really knocked out, right, in the sense of dropping the packet. Okay. Or you can use several Banyan fabrics in parallel. All this is very expensive. Okay. Now what you do is there's another like cute way to avoid blocking. Okay. In addition to all this knockout and buffering business, what you can do is I said if the worst case of blocking in Banyan is when you have a whole bunch of inputs which want to go to the same output. Right. Now what you could do is this is possible. It's a random event, right? It's quite possible. Okay, but essentially you say that suppose I take 8 inputs, okay, so a sequence of 8 inputs coming at any input port, it is not likely that all of these things will block. right? So what you do is over time, right, you take a bunch of input packets and then you essentially sort them, okay? And you sort them to guarantee that at any stage you will never have things will go to the same output. Okay, so essentially what you do is you precede the Banyan network, which is essentially a multi-stage network, with a sorting stage. The sorting stage essentially guarantees an arbitration type of stage, which essentially sorts it to make sure that you will not have contention. You sort out the contention. And then it is, I mean, one could ask the case that, I mean, it is possible that if I have random arrivals, even the sorting might not succeed. Okay, in that case, what you do is you trap the thing which does not succeed and you feed it back. Okay, so you have something known as a trap network, and then you feed it back through a buffer and try to contend again. See, so the whole idea is that you try to take advantage of the random input stream, have a small trap and feedback stage, and such that at the Banyan stage is guaranteed to be non-blocking. The price you pay is that some of these packets might be delivered out of order, etc., and some of these packets might be delayed. If you're to the extent you're willing to sacrifice that, you can do this thing. Okay, the moment you start doing other fancy things, like I want to have delay guarantees, or I want to have bandwidth guarantees for some flows, or I want to have multicast, right? I'm forced to not reorder packets. All this is thrown out of the window. So that's why switch design is complex. Suppose you reduce the requirements of switch design and you can handle all the stupid reordering business end to end, like we can, but we don't. The switches become much more complex and costly. Okay, so that is the fundamental problem. So, and the sorting stages, by the way, can also be built out of standard merging blocks. Okay, remember that one of the sorting algorithms which is available is known as merge sort. Okay, the way merge sort works is it takes a small two sorted lists and merges them. So to get a larger sorted list, then it takes larger sorted lists, merges them. So this is known as merge sort, right? So essentially you can build a bunch of merge stages and you can achieve the sorting. Okay, the sorting is also sometimes called shuffling. So this is why it's called shuffle exchange network sometimes. I mean, you might hear that name. Okay, and then you recurse. The recurse means that I think it's there somewhere. There's a trap network which picks up things which are not really sorted and then feeds them back. Okay. So this is how the switch will look at. So when you buy a switch hardware, which is called a Batcher Banyan network, it has a Banyan self-routing network like this. It's very simple. And then a Batcher sorting network, which is also built out of a simple set of merge components. So the whole thing can be realized as one chip. Okay, and I showed you 8 to 8. There's an 8x8 crossbar basically. I mean, it's like not really a crossbar, but it's a multi-stage switch. You can build 64x64 of this type. Okay. With that, so this whole thing, so the fabric is essentially scheduling the arrivals to this Banyan network. Okay, by the way, as in the last point, just says that even though this whole thing becomes non-blocking now, even though the original Banyan was blocking, the reason we did this was to make this thing non-blocking, right? Now, unfortunately, this only works for unicast. The moment you say I want to do multicast, this whole thing is still blocking. So people have analyzed multicast as well, and they have proposed architectures which can do both blocking, non-blocking, and so on, but this debate continues. Okay, so we'll stop here and continue from this point next lecture.